long-term ambition is to be a global renewable energy infrastructure company. You know, there's a hell of a lot of renewable energy infrastructure that needs to be built over the next 20 to 30 years globally. The biggest amount of infrastructure kind of ever. And the speed at which that needs to happen is insane, as you say. And, you know, there need to be lots of companies and lots of people who understand how to like finance new energy infrastructure, build it, and then also operate and monetize it.
Develop, build, own, operate, optimize as well, get them into the market. So you can do the whole shebang.
There's, you know, it's not necessarily just about price and, you know, improving returns by removing a cost that you're paying someone else to do. I think a lot of it's to do with autonomy. We want to just build as much infrastructure and technology as possible that helps the energy transition, helps accelerate it.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back for another installment of our Modo Select series, where we revisit some of our earlier episodes. This episode is from March 22 with Amit Goodker, founder of Field Energy. You may have seen the news of Field's recent £200 million fundraise in order to help them reach their ambitious goals of becoming a full life cycle battery storage developer, owner, and operator. When we spoke to Amit last year, Field were in a much earlier stage of their journey. And so today we are revisiting that episode where Amit outlines his overarching mission and how he thought, at the time, Field would go about achieving it. As always, if you're enjoying the podcast, please hit like and subscribe. And if you want to see more content from the Modo team, follow us on LinkedIn.
Hi, everybody. Quentin here from Modo. I'm here sat with Amit in probably the most East London of all East London shared working spaces. And today we're going to be talking about life at Field, Amit's experience and what's coming next. So Amit, really pleased to have you on. We're absolutely chuffed to be sat here doing this. And thanks for hosting us.
Thanks, Quentin. Yeah, good to see you.
And there's a lot of greenery behind us. And I guess for anyone watching, you might notice there's someone eating over there. And there's a dog.
There's a very trendy dog there.
So, so firstly, Amit, what's going on in energy markets at the moment? You come from a background of trading and you've been around for a long time. Just a quick take before we get stuck into your experience and Field. What on earth's happening in energy markets?
I think there's been two really big, the biggest theme over the last year has been global gas prices, right? Mm-hmm. So huge demand from Asia that's taken a lot of the LNG to Asia, combined with low storage levels at the end of last year. Sort of the perfect storm on the gas front. But I think what's really interesting is behind that, we've actually had this really, the electricity volatility story that's been building for a while.
What's your background? Start with the trading experience and then what's got you to Field, and then we can talk about Field. But start with trading, because that's we haven't had anyone on the show yet talking about what it's like to be a trader. So what does that involve?
Yeah, so started out as a gas and power trader, focused on European markets and the UK market. That was the first job out of university, starting as an analyst.
There's lots of screens and call phones and
I think there's probably more screens than people actually need. I think sort of screens probably become a bit of a status symbol probably for traders than they're actually required. But yeah, I started out as an analyst, and so the main focus was on supply and demand for gas and electricity across Europe. Main focus was on UK markets and UK gas in particular. Did that for a few years, then progressed into actually trading. So was doing that at a bank. What you do initially is take customer orders. So there'll be a customer, maybe a utility, who needs to hedge their gas.
Yep.
And you provide prices to them. And then over time, you sort of progress to trading more markets. So really enjoyed, you know, doing that. I think markets are really, you know, intellectually really interesting, and power and gas markets in particular. I think after a while, just started to just question what maybe the real like value add of just trading itself was. Uh-huh. It felt a bit zero sum game. It's kind of, it's intellectually interesting, but you know, questioned really the value add after a while. And so got really thinking about the energy sector more widely. And that's when I sort of left in 2014 to set up Bulb, the energy supplier. Really exciting sort of few years there. I mean, obviously, it's been in the news, been an unfortunate outcome for that business over the last year. I left there just over a year ago to set up Field.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, that's what we're doing now.
I tell you, we were talking before we recorded this. I'm just going to turn my phone off. It's making a load of noise. We were talking before this that you started Bulb in the same offices we're in now, right? Yeah. And you're doing the same thing again with Field, which was called Vermity or Vermati before?
Vermity, yeah.
And you changed the name recently to Field.
Hmm.
And so what's Field trying to do?
Yeah, so just the point on Vermity as well. So the companies, the top company actually, that holding company is still Vermity.
Okay.
My grandma's name, and you know, is who you know passed away a couple of years ago. So that's who the Topco is named after. Field is our sort of brand name and go-to-market name.
Mm-hmm.
I think as you just found. Pronouncing Vermity wasn't probably the most natural
Apologies.
Thing.
Yeah.
No, I think it's actually quite a hard name to pronounce. So that's why we've or one of the reasons we've moved to Field. And so yeah, Field, what we're doing, long term ambition is to be a global renewable energy infrastructure company. And you know, there's a hell of a lot of renewable energy infrastructure that needs to be built over the next 20 to 30 years globally.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the biggest amount of infrastructure kind of ever in the shortest amount of time.
It's like wartime infrastructure, right? I think it was Michael Liebreich, someone did a thing, it was like three times wartime infrastructure in the next 30 years.
Exactly.
From World War II, right? Yeah. It's like, what the fuck?
Yeah, it's enormous, right? And the speed at which that needs to happen is insane, as you say. And, you know, there need to be lots of companies and lots of people who understand how to like finance new energy infrastructure,
uh-huh.
You know, build it, and then also operate and monetize it. And, you know, I think learning that skill set over the next 20 or 30 years is going to be really valuable and have a lot of impact. So that's what we're doing. We're starting with, you know, utility scale, front of the meter batteries in the UK. But, you know, over time, the longer term ambition is to move into other technologies in other countries.
Okay, cool. So just want to pick a couple of things there. So you mentioned renewable energy infrastructure. So that's beyond just batteries. So other stuff as well. And we're talking about UK, but there'll be something you're also talking about internationally. What was interesting is you also said optimize. So is Field going to be fully integrated? You're going to be, you know, develop these assets, develop, build, own, operate, optimize as well, get them into the market. So you can do the whole shebang, a bit like kind of Centrica circa 10 years ago. You know, is it that kind of, obviously, Centrica, I don't want to say Field, and no disrespect to Field or Centrica here, right? It's just different companies. But is that what you're going for?
Yeah, so really important. So look, right now, we've got our first, and I'm, you know, probably come to it in a bit, we've got our first asset that will be, our first battery that will be going live in a few months. Mm-hmm. It'll be commissioning in April. And that first project, you know, we've acquired the site from a developer.
Yep.
And we'll be using a third party optimizer for that. But in the long run, yeah, we will be doing sort of end to end, right? So we'll be developing projects from scratch, from greenfield state, you know, finding grid connections and land, and then taking it through to financing, construction. And then, yeah, optimizing it is really important. I think, you know, you want to, you know, ultimately, if you're building assets that are worth, you know, tens, hundreds of millions of pounds, ultimately, you want to have control over those assets. So I think there's, you know, it's not necessarily just about price and, you know, improving returns by removing a cost that you're paying someone else to do. I think a lot of it's to do with autonomy and control, and also the ability to expand into different markets or technologies. So that's why we want to be doing that.
Okay.
Yeah.
Makes sense. That's not new. I think we did some research recently. I think it was something like 68% of all the assets in the UK currently use a third-party optimizer. And then of the my numbers I think are right here. And then of the other 32%, a lot of those are EFR, so they don't really need optimizing. Mm-hmm. So when you discount by that, it's like actually three quarters of the market, maybe more, using optimizers. So it's interesting you're going down this route. I guess there's a scale question. When you get to a certain scale, it does make sense to bring it in-house. And if you really can go, if you can build technology faster and better, if you operationally as a business, we believe this Modo the same, right? If your USP is going fast, breaking stuff fast, and having a sort of entrepreneurial mindset, then why not do it all in-house, right? Because you can, if you believe that way, then you might as well control all of it.
Yeah.
And so what's the vision for Field? What's the world you're trying to build with Field? What does that look like?
So I think, as mentioned, we've got, you know, targets that we want to build out, you know, 300 megawatts next year. We want to build out a gigawatt the year afterwards. And, you know, that's sort of on track at the moment. But I think rather than just sort of numbers and gigawatts and et cetera, and, you know, capital deployed, I think the really important...
Bragawatts.
I think the really important thing is we want to just build as much infrastructure and technology as possible that helps the energy transition, helps accelerate it, helps, you know, all these countries that have made net zero commitments achieve them. And so that, you know, that's the overall aim. So yeah, we're saying X many megawatts over the next few years, but, you know, ultimately, and also, you know, battery storage we might look at in a few years, right? And say, this isn't the technology that makes sense anymore. And we'll be wanting to looking at other stuff and something else that actually genuinely contributes to decarbonizing. And so, yeah, I think, you know, that's the overall aim. I think putting it into numbers and capital deployed in the longer run, I think is, it's hard to say right now.
It's hard. And also, I like it because basically you're saying we're going to build as much as possible. And I guess in the next decade, you're not going to overbuild, right? As much as possible is as much as we need to build. In fact, we need more than as much as possible.
Yeah.
So why not? Why restrict yourself with numbers?
Yeah.
So Field, I want to talk about speed for a second because we know lots of people at Field work here. You know, you guys are hiring. We speak to people that who have come across Field. And one word always just resonates, which is speed, right? Field is going fast. Field is hiring fast. Field is raising fast. Field is building fast. What does speed mean to you at Field? And what's the silly question almost, but what's the advantage and why do you believe so much in it?
So the case is very clear for like battery storage in our opinion for battery storage right now. And it's something that can help decarbonize and it can help and it enables, you know, a faster build out of renewable energy and it stops renewable energy being blamed for market volatility when actually, you know,
those bloody wind farms calling up. Yeah.
Yeah. Sort of, you know, gas prices have driven the gas price. So gas has driven the gas price. But, so, you know, I think it's really important to scale up renewables but really important to scale up storage alongside it as quickly as possible. So that's why we need to go fast. Mm-hmm. But then, you know, as a business, what's the benefit? We're hiring a really great team. Like I'm so impressed with the people that we've been hiring, and people are really interested in contributing to the energy transition and making it happen fast. And so, as a business, if you are moving fast, you know you can attract better talent as well.
Yeah, yeah.
And then I think the other really important reason for moving fast is, yeah, there's a lot of other people who are also doing this. And, you know, you want to be getting into the best locations. In battery storage, location is going to become increasingly important. Mm-hmm. And so moving quickly and being in those places. And also, you know, supply chains, bottlenecks, prices have gone up recently for the first time. And so, you know, we want to be ahead of that, right? We want to be moving quickly and making sure that we're actually able to deliver on the plan that we spent a lot of time putting together.
Yeah, okay, cool. And so what's holding you back? I mean, you've mentioned a few things there, bottlenecks. So operationally as a business, you can hire the best talent, you can structure, you know, optimize the business to run really fast and make decisions quickly and perhaps without all the information, just do the, you know, operational stuff that startups do. But then the whole energy world around us is quite slow. Mm. And so what's holding you up right now? What are the things outside of your control that you can't control, which are frustratingly slow, and it's holding up the whole thing? Not holding up the company, but you know what I mean? They're holding up the energy transition as a thing. Hmm. And how are you managing that?
Yeah, and look, we talked about speed and moving fast. I think it's really important to also just be really mindful of the fact that we're not just building an app to, you know, we're not building a food delivery app or I don't know.
It's Tinder for batteries,
yeah,
right?
So, exactly. So we're not doing that. It's like meaningful infrastructure that has an important role to play, but also needs to be robust and reliable and safe.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's certain things that ultimately you can't cut corners on, right?
Yeah.
So it's just really, I think, really important to note that. And I think that point you said about moving fast and break things, you know, that's also not something that we can't, you know, with a expensive piece of kit that has, you know, safety protocols that you need to follow, that's not something you can do. So like there's an inherent speed at which things need to go, and there's an inherent sort of lumpiness to an infrastructure business that you just sort of need to respect. I think the the things around like operational, you know, within the business. And I think, you know, you start to see it, right? You have multiple sites. No, you know, in your ideal world, when you put your business plan together at the beginning, you think, right, we're going to have every single standardized site and the battery's going to look the same, the site's going to look the same. And then obviously that's not how the world works, right? Every site is different. It's each distributor's different.
Yeah.
And you have different things that you need to manage. So
I hope you've got a comfy pair of wellies if you're going out to all these sites in the middle of winter.
Yeah, I think I went on the first with Chris, who's our technical director. We went up to Scotland, so to our site in near Loch Ness. And yeah, it definitely was, yeah. The sort of city boy unprepared for that. So yeah, I'm definitely improving the kit that I've got. I think the like moving quickly on those sites is something that we want to do, but you have to respect the you know what you have to deal with health and safety. But operationally, you know, you want to standardize as much as possible. That's really important. Framework agreements with your main counterparties, not having lots of different sites. I think those things are super important. Contracts get really complicated. You know, there's big contracts that you need to deal with. And again, having a really good like organizational structure where you can manage those big contracts like, and make decisions on them quickly and effectively as a team. I think that those things are what you can do as a business, and they can actually
that's
hold up months. Yeah.
Yeah. As the alpha, if you like.
Yeah.
So any ideas on how we can change the rules of this game that we're in to make things go faster? So for example, grid connections, I know it's been a while since I've been involved in grid connections, right? But it used to be, I think 60 days we had to wait for a grid connection, or 45 days. It's just once you put an application in, like a G99 or whatever it was before, and you have to wait ages to get it back from the DNO. So these kind of things that take a while. Now, what can we... That's just one idea. What else can we do to reduce barriers and get this stuff done faster? What's frustrating you?
I mean, the DNO, yeah, the time it takes to get a grid connection off a bat. We've not, like I said, we've not actually done these first sites. We haven't actually done the connection applications ourselves.
So it's like ready to go sites, yeah, made ready.
Exactly. Right. But it's something that we're moving into.
Mm-hmm.
The connection side, I think it's really interesting, right? So everyone will complain about the speed of distributors here or National Grid or whatever to respond. But, you know, we've started looking at international, right? We've started looking at Europe, and the grid application processes there are just not standardized. It's not like there's not a standardized way of going about it with, you know, the way that DNOs are run here. There's quite a lot of rules around how they have to respond, when they have to respond, what the response needs to look like, and what they commit to. And that's definitely not the case in Europe. So, you know, we're kind of, and that's the reason why the UK is much more mature as a storage market, right? As a merchant storage market, because
there's rules of the game.
There's rules of the game that are set up that enable, you know, new players to come into it. And so I think in that sense, the UK is actually in a relatively good place. I think I think it's going to be interesting as we move from distribution connected storage more to transmission connections. It'll be interesting to see, you know, because I think the distribution connection storage model is actually running relatively effectively.
Mm,
I think.
Yeah, yeah.
And you know, you can see it scaling up quite fast. It'll be interesting to see how that goes as you get to these much bigger projects. Which again, I think when you're having 400 megawatt batteries that go up, you know, this is power station size, right? And, you know, arguably you can't go as fast as you can with a 20 to 50 megawatt distribution connected battery. So I think that would be an interesting step change.
Yeah, we had Bridget from Orsted on a couple of weeks ago, and she was talking about co-locating storage on wind sites. Hmm. So like, I don't know, I think it was Dogger Bank or one of these offshore wind sites. And they're looking at like a... the sizes they're talking about, it's like 2 gigawatts, 8 gigawatt hour battery. It's like, dude, that's like four times the whole, like, more than that, five times the whole UK market. So things are going to get much, much bigger very fast. Not necessarily grid connected for just the standalone model, but co-located as well.
Yeah.
All numbers are going up.
Yeah.
I want to talk to you about investor sentiment. You've been out in the market and you've started Field and you're building assets. And I'm assuming that's brought on, so you've had to bring on some external capital to do that, right?
Yeah.
I think that's a pretty safe assumption. And so you've been speaking to investors and probably getting a lot of attention. What does investor appetite look and feel like now? And I ask that because The merchant case for storage is fairly well established now, but it's taken a few years to kind of get everyone's head around it. And the market's changing so fast. And it feels like investors, as soon as they understand one model, it all changes. So how are you dealing with the ambiguity of that? And how are you communicating that to investors? Is it becoming easier? Are people becoming more comfortable with it? I'm putting words in your mouth now. I don't know. What's it like on the roadshow with Amit?
Yeah, I think it's so I started looking at, you know, in detail on batteries probably like two and a half years ago. And I think the whole, you know, everything's moved on in terms of like lender appetite and also in equity investor appetite. Yeah. And so, you know, the previously for on the lending side, you definitely needed floor price from an entity, from your optimizer contract, from someone with a really big balance sheet, and the floor price and also the amount that you paid in commission above the floor price was really high.
Mm-hmm.
And that's completely, so I guess on the optimizer side, it's become more competitive. And so you can get floor price contracts paying lower commissions now. And then also lenders don't necessarily just require a floor price, right? They've got sufficiently comfortable and understand the market enough that they understand what a kind of base level, real downside case, like level of revenue that they can expect from batteries, and they've got more comfortable with that. So that's, I think that's like, that's a big shift. And, you know, that really opens up the low cost of capital, you know, money into storage. So that's been quite a big change. And I think there's something that's becoming almost quite standardized there. So I think that's a really exciting development. I think on the equity side, huge interest in energy transition, like ESG, and, you know, the sustainability. There's, you know, every fund out there has some angle on that.
Mm-hmm.
I think then when you actually get into the detail though of battery storage, and it's funny, we're in the battery storage space. So you think, God, it's moved on so far. It's so mature. We're going too slow. We're behind. Like, you know, you have all of those things. And then actually when you go out further, you realize how sort of new an asset class it is. So it's finding within all of those, hundreds of different, you know, firms that are out there and funds that can invest, is finding the ones where you're sort of pushing on an open door, right? So not many are fully educated about the battery business case, but there are quite a few out there that are willing to, that have started thinking about it and are interested. Also think about, previously it's just been, let's just invest in software.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, software alone isn't going to like solve the energy transition, right? It's like, there's a lot of hardware involved as well. There's a lot of infrastructure. So I think that's the sort of mindset shift that I'm seeing a bit more of, or at least we're starting to speak to the people in that space who are interested in doing that.
And what about the merchant case? Investors comfortable with the kind of with the whole thing around merchants? So much deeper markets, so they should be happier, you'd think, because the fear of a frequency response becoming full, if you like, kind of diminishes when you can make money on spreads. But are they comfortable with the I'm not going to say unpredictability of that, because if you believe in renewables penetration and volatility long term, then it's going to be there. But are they comfortable with the idea of merchant now in a way that has that changed in the last couple of years, or has it been fine?
Yeah, that's changed definitely, right? So merchant is, you know, I think there's clearly like a base level of revenues that people understand that they can expect from a batch. So there's a base level of spread.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously it's well below the level of spreads that we're seeing today, or we've seen over the last 6 months. But I think there's definitely, people have got comfortable with the fact that, yeah, it's not, you're not just putting, these are deep markets. The wholesale market is a deep market, and there's a certain level of spread that can be supported by these assets. So yeah, the sort of appetite to invest therefore in merchant projects is really increased.
Awesome. Let's talk about one of your assets at the moment. So you mentioned earlier you're building an asset right now. Is it the one in Scotland? If you could talk through what you're building and how that works and how you found building your first asset and what you've learned, that'd be awesome.
Yes, yeah, so the first one's actually in Oldham, so near Manchester.
Okay.
So that's a 20 megawatt, 1 hour duration project.
Mm-hmm.
It's on an industrial site. It's actually, so look, we're kind of steep learning curve, right? So
okay.
You sort of, first thing when you go into it, you speak to a number of developers, We found this site had a really sort of attractive grid connection and, you know, date and also cost. Mm-hmm. And so we moved forward with that. Then obviously, you know, we start unpeeling, you know, what's actually going on with the land, with the planning permission. The one that we've got actually initially is actually in an energy barn or a warehouse.
Okay.
So that has its own like challenges as well. So, you know, we've learned kind of everything along the way of doing that. And I think, yeah, it's been a really important learning curve for us to be on. I think the really important thing for us has been, let's move quickly on this. Obviously in a low risk manner, but let's, you know, for that first project, I think we could have spent a lot longer going around every single site that was available. And you know, we ultimately ended up with a much shorter list and we just went for something that we could work on soon. Because yeah, developing the actual understanding of how batteries work, how construction works, how planning permission works was so important. And it's, you know, it's a, even for members in the team who have worked in batteries, but you know, in potentially at optimizers, or developers, actually doing a full project from end to end is new.
So the new experience.
So yeah, really good experience. So we've learned a lot from that. It's all on track, commissioning. So I say right now publicly, but like,
so someone's going to walk past and put like a note on the window.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah. You need to get out the top. But yeah, all on track for sort of commissioning in Q2 of this year. So we're really excited with the progress on that.
So we have first field battery on the Lomoda leaderboard as well soon. Very excited about that.
Yeah, exactly. Well, yeah, until, you know, and then we got to see the performance. But yeah.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's all very public now how that performs, which is what you guys do so well. So yeah, I think that's really, you know, really exciting with the progress that we made there. Behind that, we've got two more projects that we've publicly announced that we've acquired. So there's one in Gerrard's Cross, so towards the west of London.
Oh, I used to live in Beaconsfield, so it would have been in my backyard and I would have voted for it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, and yeah, Beaconsfield, they've got a nice model village there.
Oh, they've got a lovely model village. Yeah. But yeah.
So that's the next one. And again, that will probably be a 1 hour duration battery with connection and energization due in Q1 2023. Mm-hmm. And then we've got our sort of largest one so far is a 50 megawatt and likely to be 2 hour duration.
Yep.
It's a 50 megawatt, 100 megawatt hour project up in the north of Scotland.
Wow, big project.
Yeah. So that's, you know, again, that location, it suits itself better, right? For longer duration. You know, that it's an area of constraint. So a lot of the wind farms there and the substation that goes into a lot of the wind farms get constrained. So, you know, I think there's that could be quite an attractive place to do a longer duration asset.
Awesome. And you mentioned that, so not shopping around too much for, so obviously you've found some sites you're comfortable with and they meet your risk profile. But so we did some analysis that pretty much, it's like the Bitcoin story, right? Anyone who bought Bitcoin and didn't sell up until a certain point was always in the money, right? And it's the same with batteries. If you go back to 2016 when the first asset started being built, pretty much all of them have outperformed what we estimate the business case was, apart from a brief blip where FFR hit like £5 in 2017 and 2018 for a bit. And everyone was like, oh, the market's over, it's saturated. And then like 6 months later, it switched on again. And the people who are winning this market, who people have got operational assets, not just talking about operational assets. So, I mean, I can completely understand why you went down that route. So three assets, one's going to be built soon. Two more coming soon as well. And then are you looking beyond the UK for the next ones, or are you going to stay here?
Yes, we've got a couple more that are like basically planning decisions are due this week, and then we would acquire those and take those into construction as well.
Cool.
So, and you know, with the target of 300 megawatts by the end of 2023, which right now is still on.
Yeah, yeah.
So, I think that's the thing, like we moved quickly initially on that first site and things are becoming more locational specific. Mm-hmm. And I think, again, like I mentioned, for something that's situated in somewhere like Scotland, I think longer duration makes more sense. I think that's going to be interesting how that unfolds. Probably going back to your point around what are things that could almost help, you know, help move things along or blockers. There's still quite a lot of uncertainty over, you know, embedded export tariffs, et cetera. And I think that stuff, obviously, you know, changes your outlook on places like Scotland, right? It sort of changes the business case significantly.
Especially when it's in the first couple of years of business case, because it matters so much.
Yeah.
It's funny, the Scottish thing. So for me, the biggest issue is, so if you think it through, wind gets bid down in Scotland in the BM and there's thermal constraints. Mm. And so it makes sense that you should be able to capture loads of value by building your assets in Scotland. The problem is the market doesn't really let you do that too much yet, because you're limited by the transmission constraint license condition and other stuff. And really, for the good of the system, we should be encouraging people to build shed loads of storage in Scotland. But the market, the way it's designed, doesn't really, you don't get the reward that you should get for doing that. Since it's such a long way and it's so cold to go around in your wellies. But other than that, you don't get the reward that it provides to the system, which is a real shame. One other thing you mentioned earlier, I just want to pick up on before we finish up. So you talked about CapEx and prices going up. Mm. I don't want any details because it's all commercially sensitive, but what are you seeing out there in the market? And is it a worry?
I mean, look, it's was probably going to happen at some point, mm-hmm. right? So, you know, battery costs have been on a downward trend for forever. And, you know, now the raw material prices are catching up with that increased demand. So, but, you know, a 400% increase in lithium prices last year, ultimately it's going to find its way into battery costs. I think, you know, lithium prices are up again, lithium carbonate prices are up again significantly again this year. So it's very likely that battery prices will go up again this year, and you know that feeds ultimately into your CapEx for your like total system cost 5-10%, and that's material, you know, when you're that's material for your business case. So I think that changes it doesn't change whether you actually build batteries or not, but it changes the way you finance them, right? It changes the amount that you can borrow against it, it changes the return profile. So I think it's going to be the feed through of that, and obviously we've seen such like excitement in the space, and you know, obviously we're part of that, right? In there and we're building, we're trying to go fast. It would be, what's the knock-on effect on that into batteries? You know, everyone's always thought, oh, what's going to happen when dynamic containment revenues go down, or what happens when volatility reduces? But I think no one was really thinking what's going to happen when battery prices go up. Expectation was that would just, the battery price would continue going down forever.
Because the solar and the wind curve has done that.
Exactly. So I think that's like, it's going to be interesting. Does that, the speed at least of announcements that we've seen this year, is that going to change that? And it remains to be seen. And it does impact your return profile and how much you can borrow. So ultimately, it must slow things down a little bit.
Yeah, definitely. And I mean, you're a commodities trader, so you'll understand this a lot better than me. But for me, if supply and demand of lithium prices, for example, or this commodities in general, but particularly lithium, anything that's required for a battery. Mm. So price shoots up. What's going to bring price down again? Either demand is going to be suppressed, or a supply side is going to get oversupplied. Mm. And of course, there's new mines setting up and people are digging for lithium in places that they never thought of. Mm. But it's still slower than expected. And then on the demand side, where is the demand going to slow down? Right? Where on earth are people going to stop buying lithium ion batteries for cars or for electronics or for stationary storage? I just don't see it, right? Mm. The demand side is only going one way. So unless they overbuild capacity on the mining side, which doesn't appear to be happening, you can still be bullish on lithium now, which is nuts, right? Yeah. If you look at the chart, it doesn't make any sense, but it does.
Yeah, so. Totally. And I mean, but as you mentioned as well, it's not just lithium, right? It's copper, it's graphite, you know, those costs have been, well, I mean, it's shipping as well, right? So you know, we saw a fivefold shipping on our first project, which was, you know, we locked in prices at a very attractive level. But, you know, the shipping side moved considerably during that contracting period, and shipping is so volatile, right? So there's all.
It shouldn't be, right? Yeah. For like decades, it hasn't been.
Yeah, exactly. And suddenly, there was a 5X increase in shipping costs. And when you're shipping lots of containers of batteries from China, that's a significant increase in costs. So, you know, all of those things, all those things are moving around a lot. It's not just lithium.
And so just to finish up, and I want to talk about the future energy system and what your vision is for it. And we talked a little bit before about technology in the future energy system, operational improvements. What do you think it looks like? Decentralization, we've also talked about. What do you think it looks like? And what's the dream?
I think decentralization is something that, yeah, we just see that happening. So I think that's where we get to. And I think you get to this, you know, the future energy utopia where the home is an energy hub and, you know, you have your solar and your battery and your EV. And I think that stuff we will sort of get there. But, you know, I think the progress to that takes quite a long time, right? It's taken so long to roll out smart meters in this country. Like, you know, we're years behind where that should be. So I think that, and also the shift in like consumer sentiment.
Why was that, by the way? We always talk about like front of meter batteries. We never really talk about supply size. So why is it so slow for me to roll out? Putting you on the spot here. So I know you're going to know.
I think it was because it was. Like in other countries where they rolled them out really quickly, it was done by the distributor, it was done by the grid. And then they just go street by street and install smart meters as opposed to here where it was a supplier-led rollout. And I think then there were lots of suppliers, as we know, and I think that just complicated the rollout of it. So I think that's the supplier-led probably made sense when there were only a few very large suppliers, but I think that's all got muddy during that time. But
sorry, I took you completely off into the old Amit.
Yeah,
sorry,
yeah.
New Amit. So future energy system, decentralization. Everyone's going to have this little self-fulfilling. That's not the right word. Everyone's going to make their own energy themselves.
Yeah, self-autonomous. Blah, blah, yeah, blah, blah, self-sufficient. Yeah.
Okay, this sounds like a good utopia.
Yeah, and I think we do sort of head in that direction. Well, actually, there's two ways about it. So I think my view's been that just shifting consumer sentiment in order for that to become a reality, and it's quite complicated and it can be expensive, will actually take a while. And, you know, in the short run, there are things such as like front of the meter utility scale battery that can achieve a lot of that transition that needs to be made. On the flip side, I think the energy price shock that we've seen over the last year has been so significant and it's been, you know, so extreme that actually maybe it will push some of that stuff forwards like faster than it was going. So I think you're seeing quite interesting like pilots that are happening. You know, there's one between National Grid and Octopus, I think now, which is a sort of demand reduction at a customer level, at a domestic level. And I think that stuff's starting to happen quite fast.
Mm-hmm.
You're seeing other things like the capacity market price that we saw yesterday for the T-1. You know,
£75 for anyone who's watching. Yes,
so,
bizarre.
Know, and I think those are, they're like extreme, like they're faster or extreme reactions to the extreme price events over the last year. So you could actually see things actually accelerate almost quicker as a result. So maybe what we've seen over the last year ends up being like a blessing in disguise for
kick up the backside.
For like improving flexibility and, you know, and speeding up decentralization. So, you know, that's the hope.
Awesome. So I think we've run out of time. I just want to say thank you for coming on and thanks for hosting us in this utopian East London, coolest place I've ever been, I think. Thanks for hosting us. Thanks for coming on. And if anyone's got any questions, if you're watching this, comment, let us know what you think. Ask some questions and we can try and get back to you and make sure you hit the subscribe button. That's it. Thanks very much.
Thanks.
Cheers, Amit.
Thanks, Quentin. Cheers.